Welcome back. It's a Thursday, the 27th day of December, 2018. I'm your host, Mark Call. And let's start off today with a bit more of the news that ordinarily would probably be submerged in all kinds of smoke and mirrors. But given that it's a quiet week, these things do percolate to the top, especially, of course, if you don't get your news from the Ministries of Truth. Starting with this one from Christina Layla via the Gateway Pundit. The DOJ, and that still, unfortunately, stands for the Department of Just Us, has been caught colluding with Clinton email scandal witnesses to thwart efforts by the court to actually engage in discovery of criminal activities. This according to Tom Fitton, president of Judicial Watch, who revealed all of this on Wednesday. Judicial Watch appeared in a D.C. federal court last month on a motion to compel more testimony from Hillary Clinton, as well as to make public various video recordings of depositions of top Clinton aides, such as Huma Abedin and Cheryl Mills. The court, for what it's worth, ruled that Hillary Clinton must answer more questions about the setting up of her illegal and treasonous, yes, private email server. She arrogantly answered that she set up the private server because it was more convenient for her. And I guess that really makes sense in hindsight, doesn't it? Earlier this month, a federal court blasted the DOJ and State Department on Hillary's emails and ordered a discovery plan in 10 days as to whether the private email server was intentionally set up, do you think, to evade FOIA requests and lawsuits. Judge Lamberth, at that point, said Hillary's private email server was, quote, one of the gravest modern offenses to government transparency, unquote. And that doesn't seem to have abated. And although Judicial Watch refuses to back down, the Department of Just Us is actively doing everything it can to stonewall their efforts to gather evidence in mere federal courts. Tom Fitton was, of course, furious that the DOJ is still working to block their discovery efforts and said, quote, outrageously, the Just Us Department is colluding with the Clinton email scandal to stop our efforts to gather evidence in federal court. President Trump ought to ask this Just Us Department why it's still protecting, you know, the one that he once said, lock her up, Hillary Clinton. So there's treason from within. On the invasion from without front, we have this from the Daily Mail out of the UK. It's an enormous flow, says the headline. In the wake of two migrant children's deaths in custody, the commissioner of the U.S. Customs and Border Protection Agency has said that migrants bringing children into the country are literally flooding across the border illegally at an unprecedented rate, straining the agency's ability to even process them. Appearing on CBS's This Morning, the commissioner of the CBP, Kevin McAleenan, said that migrants, perhaps or without question, incentivized by all kinds of legal loopholes and recent high-profile court decisions saying, hey, if you can just get across by hook or by crook, well, the traitors already within the gates will take care of everything else. We're bringing children across the border illegally in huge numbers. Our stations, he said, aren't built for the group that's crossing today. They were built 30 or 40 years ago for primarily single adult males. And today we need a different approach. He said that while the agency has more than 1,500 emergency medical technicians on staff, officers are still taking dozens of sick children to hospitals each and every day. Quote, what we're seeing is more children than ever before coming into custody, he said. At this pace, by the end of December, we'll have had almost 25,000 children, most of them accompanied by, at least allegedly anyway, parents who've crossed our border and are arriving in custody. That's an enormous flow, and it's very different than we've seen before. He went on to say that in the El Paso sector, where both child deaths in the last month, including the latest on Christmas Eve, occurred, they've seen a surge in illegal immigration from Central America, what with the recent formation of the migrant caravans and, as he put it, commercial bus services operated by criminal cartels, which transport migrants to the U.S. border from their home countries in a matter of days. Can you say subsidized invasion, folks? Even though, no, the waste stream isn't about to. Switching gears now, as I mentioned yesterday, the plunge protection team finally managed to kick things into gear on Wednesday. Before the day was out, U.S. stocks, say all of the headlines, just had their very best day ever in all of history. Point-wise, anyway, as the Dow closed up 1,086 points, shattering the old record by a staggering 150 points. But without doubt, there's certainly more to it than meets the eye. Here's a headline from DataTrack Research that kind of summarizes at least a bit of the reason why. Healthy markets, they say, don't rally 1,086 points on the Dow. But even with Wednesday's rally, December's 11 to 13% declines in the S&P 500 and Russell 2000 for U.S. stocks couldn't have come at a worse time for markets. Yes, there's the psychological damage of seeing such a swoon in what was normally at least a good month for domestic equities, you know, the Christmas rally. And there's also the magnitude of the decline, erasing solid year-to-date gains in just a few weeks and making 2018 the first down year for U.S. stocks since the last financial crisis a decade ago. We'll come back to that theme in just a minute, but first the question of why. Another story by Zero Hedge says, well, would you believe a massive $64 billion buy order? In all the chaos over the last few days, a story that came from Wells Fargo was kind of lost against all the other news about mutual fund liquidation that's been talked about for some time, because now, remember, people have to give notice well in advance before they're allowed to have what they thought was their money from their funds. And yes, notes Tyler Durden, we didn't anticipate that President Trump would activate the plunge protection team over the weekend. The good news, though, had to do with Wells Fargo calculating U.S. defined benefit pension funds and the fact that they would need to implement what they called a giant rebalancing out of bonds and into stocks. In fact, the biggest in history, with the bank estimating something on the order of $64 billion in equity purchases would be needed in the last trading days of the quarter and the year, prompting the banks to ask if traders are about to make pension rebalancing great again. And in case you're curious, the massive rebalancing and the huge end-of-quarter buy order was precipitated by what they called a jarring divergence between equity and bond performances both in the fourth quarter and in the month of December. Maybe you could call it the unintended consequences of years of interest rate manipulations. Yeah, payback definitely is a you-know-what, resulting, it would seem, in a whole lot of reshuffling. Well, yesterday seems to suggest the answer is a resounding yes. Even though, they say, the markets may yet have to deal with one more seismic bout of volatility before the year finally rings out on December 31st. Which brings us next to a nice summary by Michael Snyder of the Economic Collapse blog. Same theme. U.S. stocks, he says, had their best day ever. And why? That's a really bad sign. Yes, this was in fact the kind of Santa Claus rally that at least some investors had been hoping for, those that haven't been betting in the down direction anyway. But for the moment, the mainstream media is pushing this narrative as a sign that once again, everything is just peachy keen, nothing to worry your pretty little heads about, going back to sleep. He quotes the criminally negligent network to make that point. I don't think we need to. Suffice it to say, it includes the words, back up the truck. Snyder, of course, takes us on a tour down memory lane, noting that on October 28, 2008, the DJIA rose by a then-record 889 points, the second biggest daily point increase in U.S. history. But no, the crisis wasn't over. The Dow kept falling until it eventually bottomed out in early 2009. What we're seeing now at this phase in the market is volatility, big moves in both directions. Michael Snyder, too, then goes on to point to the Zero Hedge story about forced pension rebalancing as a big part of the reason for the latest big move up as corporate pension money shifts from bonds to stocks. But don't forget that global economic activity continues to deteriorate. And ultimately, of course, a one-day move doesn't change the long-term outlook one bit. Look for more volatility to come, especially as markets increasingly begin to reflect volatility in other aspects of the world situation. Oh, and if you're curious what that means today, well, for example, the Dow Jones is back down, as I do the recording, over 500 points. Similarly, the S&P 500, percentage-wise, and NASDAQ's down almost 200. Paper, gold, and silver, though, have had a quiet rally. The proxy for real, honest money is up 11 bucks, or just about 1% in the case of gold, right around 1280, while silver is again above $15, closer to $15.30 even, to an ounce, and no, that's still a fiat ounce. You'll probably have to pay more to put the real stuff in your real hand. Two more stories today that very definitely fit into the not only quiet week category, but largely waystream overlooked as well. From Matt Agarist at the Free Thought Project, as hemp has been, well, I think the term decriminalized is better, not really legalized. from the new farm bill, to Facebook is now banning hemp pages. I guess they were racist. Or maybe this particular private industry really has a cozy relationship with Big Pharma, too. Production of industrial hemp, he begins, has been banned by the Big Brother national government since 1937, ostensibly due to the plant's similarities to marijuana, but many have speculated this move was also due to the fact that cannabis is a direct contributor to the pharmaceutical industry by providing far safer alternative treatments as well. However, all of this has changed in the last month after President Trump signed the Agricultural Improvement Act of 2018, aka the Farm Bill, legalizing, I gotta put the word sick in after that, industrial hemp on a national scale. And since it seems too Facebook knows where their bread is buttered, they're now coming up with excuses to ban hemp pages as well. One was a grower called Franny's Pharmacy that was banned. Facebook gave the usual bogus reasons for banning them, claiming they were promoting the sale of prescription pharmaceuticals, which isn't true. Although maybe they could truthfully make the exact opposite case, and that's the real problem. And the owner, Franny Tacey, says she's an ex-pharmaceutical rep, so she knows the ropes, and quote, "There's no way we posted anything that violates Facebook terms of service. We make no claims, we make no recommendations, but we do use the words hemp and CBD, and those seem to have become trigger words now as well." Two Facebook also accused the owners of encouraging drug use, although they sell no drugs whatsoever. And as this beginning to sound familiar, folks, only the excuses have changed to protect the guilty. Agoras gives other examples, like the banning of the page for the Carolina Hemp Company, for the exact same alleged reasons. And then he goes on to note that pages like Pfizer, which actually do promote the use of dangerous pharmaceuticals, are still thriving. For example, they make the drug Chantix, prescribed to people to quit smoking, which even the FDA has shown has caused thousands of serious injuries and dozens of deaths. Note the contrast with the things that they are banning. And if you look and see two Facebook's connections with things like the Atlantic Council and who runs them, none of this should be a surprise. Cartels of public-private partners of other public-private partners. Bottom line, suggests Matt Agoras, unless we fight back when it comes to sharing information that's now deemed wrongthink by the Big Brother-connected public-private partners, the problem will only continue to get worse. Here next, another disgusting story we'll no doubt see a lot more of now that the Congress has literally become treason incarnate. And by that, folks, I mean that when people already pre-announce that they intend to put their hand on a Bible, lie through their teeth, and make war against the American people and their once God-given constitutionally protected rights, you know things are just plain gonna get ugly. This comes courtesy of James Wesley Rawls via his survival blog and also a number of other sites, including Daisy Luther's, The Organic Prepper, and so forth. He has a legislative alert, he says, regarding another unconstitutional abomination, H.R. 7115, the so-called 3D Firearms Prohibition Act. On its face, says Rawls, one of the most unconstitutional laws ever written, sponsored by Democrat from New Jersey, and I guess I almost have to say where else nowadays, Frank Pallone Jr. And yes, folks, if we still had any constitutional integrity, since this has certainly been witnessed by more than two or three people, he should be tried for treason on this alone. Well, at least the title is honest. The 3D Firearms Prohibition Act seems to literally ban 3D guns. Can you think of any that aren't, short of a photograph? I guess what that means is the only guns you'll be permitted to have are 2D guns. Presumably pictures or something, but they'll be banned from Facebook. Rawls says that regardless of the illiterate title here, this bill is purported to ban 3D printed guns. But it also includes and is primarily about milling or subtractive technology rather than additive technology or 3D printing. And of course, as Rawls notes, all guns are 3D once they come off the drawing boards. Furthermore, the bill goes far beyond banning milling machine processes, and you already knew that, didn't you? It had banned firearms parts kits, ban electronic publishing of about 80% of the receivers offered for sale, require the owners, sick, of receiver blanks to beg the issuance of a serial number before they could be milled, and even retroactively, hey, that was unconstitutional once too, bans unserialized receivers made all the way back to 1968, and sets an arbitrary 90-day limit for all of this stamping and engraving, or else. So yeah, as he puts it all together, and we're getting used to this, the proposed law is void for vagueness. It violates the ex post facto law clause. It violates an overreach of the Commerce Clause. And, of course, it violates the First, obviously Second, and Fourth, and a couple parts even of the Fifth Amendments. If you haven't been sufficiently public school indoctrinated, you can probably imagine what the founders would have done to traitors like this. From there, we go on to some good news and bad news on the anti-Second Amendment front, starting with New Jersey, where the traitors masquerading as state-level government continue to gang-rape their oaths and pretend to turn honest citizens into the real criminals. As you know, says the Free Thought Project's Matt Agarist, residents of New Jersey were given a deadline to turn in their 10-round-plus magazines or become overnight felons, and the good news is, so far, hardly anyone is complying. After New Jersey's perhaps most evil governor since the Revolutionary War era violated his oath and claimed to sign a law proclaiming the citizenry to be the violators and demanding they turn in their now forbidden property or else, citizens dutifully sued the government, citing the obviously unconstitutional nature of the ban. But it turned out their judicial branch was just as corrupt as their executive and legislative ones. But Amoland.com now says they've spoken with multiple police departments throughout the state, including two within the state police, who chose to remain anonymous, who said they don't know of any magazines turned into their agency. And the same thing seems to go for most local PDs. So it's not only true that civil disobedience to unconstitutional laws that really aren't laws may be the only way left, well, short of using those tools, for law-abiding citizens to effectively and peacefully fight back against the feckless gun grabbers. The good news is, so far at least, it seems to have been effective. And no doubt thanks to the likes of NSA, the FBI, the BATF, and Big Brother's eyes and ears in big tech, you can count on it. The data they're now gathering will be incorporated into their next anti-constitutional move. Meanwhile, though, they've already tipped their hand with this piece. New York City's Ministry of Propaganda and the Toilet Paper of Record has come out and said they would like to have credit card companies monitor sales of guns and ammo. As RedState.com correctly notes, this is simply a cry for a return of the Obama-era fascist Operation Choke Point, where the Treasury tried to bully banks into dropping firearms vendors as customers, with the addition of ensuring harassment of private citizens who've committed no crime as a way of intimidating others. Says the gun-grabbing gray lady in a propaganda piece entitled How Banks Unwittingly Finance Mass Shootings, credit cards have become a crucial part of allowing peons the access to the guns and ammo that make such things possible. So elected officials need to force their financial system to act. Don't throw me in the briar patch, Brer Rabbit. And they ought to monitor the purchases of every credit card owner and act to prevent anything that appears to a computer, or coming soon, an AI, to look suspicious. Which, of course, means anything that people might use to defend ourselves from the likes of them. And all of this goes hand in hand with New York's heavy-handed harassment of corporations with any kind of business relationships with purveyors of firearms or supporters thereof, like the NRA. So having failed in their attempt to actually outlaw or steal weapons so far, the left is looking to harness the energy of the administrative state in making the manufacture, sale, ownership, and feeding of guns as fraught with difficulty as possible. And they'll use the almighty public-private partnership to do it. Not everyone, though, can be deprived of the once God-given right to keep and bear arms. On next we go to a quick reminder of what it's like to really be above the law. And we're not just talking the whoremeisters like Comey and Mueller, or even the Peter Strzoks of the world. Remember the break-dancing FBI agent that shot a fellow in a bar in Denver and then quickly slipped out? Originally, it looked like he might have gotten away with it, but footage at the June 2nd shooting at Mile High Spirits and Distillery showed Bishop breakdancing in the middle of a circle of people before doing a backflip, whereupon his gun fell to the ground. He negligently shot a bystander as he picked it up, then quickly shoved the gun back into a waistband holster and disappeared into the crowd with his hands up. But the video went viral, and Chase Bishop, age 30, has now struck a deal with prosecutors, sick, and been sentenced to 2 whole years of probation. He also has to pay over $1,600 in fines and court costs. But unlike the rest of you peons who might have spent up to 16 years in the hooscow for less, i.e. second-degree assault, Bishop is certainly doing better than the man he shot, Tom Reddington, age 24, who spoke emotionally in court about how he lost his job in an Amazon warehouse after the shooting, about his chronic pain, and his concern that he may never be able to run again. But he doesn't hold a personal grudge against the guy who should have known better. Quote, "I've done stupid things at bars to impress girls, too," he said. And you gotta love this line from the guy's attorney. Quote, "My sense is the DA cut this guy some slack, because he was an FBI agent." Unlike, you might be thinking, how the agency treats elected presidents. Or come to think of it, even peons who still think they have a right to keep and bear arms. And I guess since we're already on the subject, we might as well recap another bit of an update from the Second Amendment battleground of New Jersey, which now has over 1 million new felons, where lawlessness already abounds, and they're taking it to a whole new level. Well, a Fourth Reich-style level, anyway. A new so-called law in New Jersey, and those of us who actually know what law is know that this isn't, says Mike Adams, makes it a felony to possess a magazine capable of holding over 10 rounds. And this wildly, insanely unconstitutional so-called law instantly has criminalized hundreds of thousands of New Jersey citizens who once thought they were free people and legally acquired normal capacity firearms and magazines, including things like 17-round pistol magazines and 30-round rifle magazines, as tools of self-defense against the very same violent criminals, he notes, that are now protected by or are the Democrats who passed the magazine gun ban. And as if all of that wasn't bad enough, or indeed obvious enough, the New Jersey State Police have now admitted to Breitbart News that they won't rule out house-to-house Nazi-style enforcement of the new magazine ban. Meaning, yeah, you knew it, they planned to conduct house-to-house arrests and gun magazine confiscations. And, of course, that will be done at gunpoint, further underscoring, says Adams, correctly, the entire purpose of the Second Amendment and the need for real free people, citizens, to arm themselves with the very things that Big Brother is so deadly serious about preventing them from having, because they're tools against the tyranny that is, in fact, already here. As Breitbart.com reported, they contacted the New Jersey State Police on Monday to ask how they plan to enforce the newly enacted ban, and were told that the New Jersey State Police refused to rule out house-to-house checks. Rather, they said, quote, "We do not discuss enforcement strategies," unquote, because otherwise people might realize what's coming and arm themselves now. And here's the really nasty, ugly part of this, folks. They are fully intending to kill people to make their point and gather their data. And whether that means some New Jersey State cops acting under color of law or a whole bunch of the citizenry, I don't think they really give a you-know-what, because ultimately, let's just admit what this is, yet another massive beta test to see how far people can be pushed and what they will do so that the jackbooted thugs can hone their techniques for the next round. As Mike Adams and your host and just about everybody else who's honestly studied this has observed for decades, this is a repeat of Nazi Germany. It is always necessary to disarm the slaves and the intended victims before you're able to mass murder them. Although I guess we do have a new Congress that's promised they're willing to use nukes to accomplish that same end. And anybody naive enough to register their guns, which amounts with the time delay to pretty much the same thing as eventually just turning them in, is literally signing their own death warrant, not to mention their children and perhaps their children's children to boot. Adams basically concludes his piece by asking the appropriate question, just how much blood are the New Jersey State Police and their communist puppet masters willing to shed to establish their dictatorial regime of absolute power? And we know the answer. As much as they need to. One more item on a very personal note today, even though we've known it was coming. After a long illness, my father passed away this morning. He's no longer in pain and at peace now, and I'm thankful for that aspect, but I certainly do appreciate your prayers for all of us who love him in this time of mourning, and especially for my mother. Harold Forsten Kahl, he will be missed. Thank you for joining us, and may Yahuwah bless you and yours.